Welcome back to the Deep Dive. You are tuning in for, well, what we think is a crucial shortcut to being well-informed about one of the most influential, complicated, and let's be honest, neurotic comedic minds of the last century.
That's a good way to put it. Neurotic is definitely the word.
Today, we are undertaking a deep, detailed exploration of John Cleese, a figure whose influence, it spans surreal sketch comedy, iconic sitcoms, blockbuster Hollywood franchises.
And more, this really sharp and often very controversial political commentary.
Exactly.
Cleese's career is less a straight line and more a series of these explosive creative partnerships.
Yeah.
And they're usually followed by these very deliberate, almost academic intellectual choices.
Right. And our stack of sources today, it gives us this phenomenal, really granular look at his entire evolution. From a young Cambridge academic using humor as a kind of defense mechanism, all the way to becoming this global voice of satire and critique.
And our mission here is to extract the crucial insights into his creative mechanism. How did he actually craft the suppressed rage of Basil Fawlty? Or the bureaucratic absurdity of the Ministry of Silly Walks.
And we really need to understand the influence of his foundational collaborations. I'm talking about Graham Chapman, Connie Booth, and even that surprising intellectual link with the psychiatrist Robin Skiner.
And crucially, we have to analyze his role as this relentless and, as you said, controversial critic of bureaucracy and modern culture. He's a master of precision.
Oh, absolutely.
The source material shows that whether he's skewering class anxiety in a 5-minute sketch or spending years writing a book on family dynamics, his underlying motivation is, well, it's almost always the same.
Challenging unearned authority.
Exactly. We're going to trace that single motivation from the schoolyard all the way to the political stage. Understanding the man who brought us both the dead parrot and, the fight for human rights through Amnesty International.
An incredible contrast. Okay, so let's unpack this and start literally at the very beginning. John Marwood Cleese was born in 1939 in Weston-super-Mare, Somerset.
Right.
But you can't really start a deep dive into a comedian whose entire work revolves around names and class and social embarrassment.
Without talking about his original family surname.
Exactly.
It's the perfect comedic seed for his whole life's work. The family name was originally Cheese.
Cheese. It's almost too good to be true.
I mean, can you imagine the sheer crushing weight of that name in the rigid British class system of the early 20th century? It's a punchline before you've even told a joke.
So his father, Reginald Francis Cleese, decided this name was just too embarrassing.
Embarrassing enough to formally change it by deed poll in 1923. Though he'd apparently already started using Cleese when he enlisted in the army during World War I.
It's the ultimate, almost biblical joke, isn't it? The man who would later create one of Python's most famous sketches, The Cheese Shop.
A satire on desperate customer service and total bureaucratic failure.
Was born into the literal, inescapable anxiety of being a cheese. It immediately establishes this kind of repressed, slightly embarrassed class anxiety that fuels so much of his comedy.
It absolutely does. It suggests a family that's striving for respectability, trying to shed a name that was maybe a bit too working class, too agricultural.
Or silly.
Too silly. And that aspiration, that desperate attempt to appear proper, is the exact pressure point Cleese targets in characters like Basil Fawlty.
Who is constantly, desperately trying to punch above his social weight.
Always. And his early education seems designed to reinforce this striving. He attended St. Peter's Preparatory School.
Paid for by his mother's inheritance, which is a classic move to maintain social standing.
Right. And later he won an exhibition to Clifton College at age 13. We see these early signs that he was much more than just a lanky comedian. He excelled not only at English, but also at the highly disciplined, very competitive sports of cricket and boxing.
That discipline is crucial. He wasn't just observing the world. He was internalizing the rules of these high-achieving environments, only so he could, deconstruct them later.
But the most telling moment, the foundational shift that really defined his whole comedy perspective, happened while he was at Clifton.
You're talking about the famous prank, the one with the Field Marshal Earl Haig statue.
Exactly. The anecdote, and it's a great one, is that he allegedly painted footprints on the ground, suggesting the statue, this stiff-backed embodiment of military authority and tradition, had climbed off its plinth.
And gone to use the outdoor toilet?
It's just an act of brilliant, low-effort surrealism. and it's aimed squarely at puncturing pomposity.
It's the physical manifestation of this intellectual realization he had. Our sources detail that at age 17, when he was passed over for the role of house prefect.
A huge deal in that kind of school.
Oh, a massive deal. He had this profound realization that authority was, and this is his quote, not fair, and therefore it was unworthy of my respect. This isn't just a disgruntled teenager. This is a philosophical shift.
That moment is the birth certificate of Basil Fawlty and of every condescending Python bureaucrat he ever played.
Mm-hmm.
It established this deep-seated irreverence for any unearned or, you know, arbitrarily maintained power. If authority isn't based on merit or fairness, Cleese concluded, then it deserves to be mocked, undermined, and held in contempt.
Which explains why his characters are so often the ones in authority who are then exposed as hopelessly incompetent or just mad.
Precisely. And as this internal revolution was brewing, his external influences were shaping his comedic language. He credits the massive influence of 1950s BBC radio comedy,
The Goon Show.
The Goon Show, written primarily by Spike Milligan and starring Peter Sellers. It was absolutely revolutionary. Cleese said kids were just obsessed with it.
And why? What was it that was so different?
Well, it completely jettisoned the traditional setup punchline structure of everything that came before. It introduced total, often aggressive, audio surrealism and non sequitur humor. It gave Cleese and the future Pythons permission to abandon linearity, to embrace the absurd, and to just follow the internal logic of madness wherever it led.
So he's ready for Cambridge, but even getting there involves this brief administrative nightmare, a perfect precursor to his later work.
It really is. He couldn't go straight to university because the ending of national service had created this huge backlog of applicants.
So he spent two unexpected years teaching science, English, history, Latin, and geography at his old prep school.
And as we see throughout Cleese's life, every single detour becomes useful. That teaching experience, specifically with Latin, was allegedly drawn upon when he wrote the scene in Life of Brian.
Oh, the graffiti scene.
The graffiti scene, yes. Where he, as a Roman centurion, corrects Brian's poorly written Latin graffiti, pointing out the improper use of declensions. It's the pedantry of a former teacher infused directly into a joke.
He eventually attended Downing College, Cambridge, Sharid Law, graduating in 1963 with an upper second. But the real education, the true creative nexus, was
the Cambridge Footlights.
Of course. His audition story for the Footlights is just a brilliant encapsulation of his whole personality, confidence wrapped in self-deprecation.
Right. When they asked him if he could sing or dance, you know, standard review stuff, he just emphatically said no. He told them he simply knew how to make people laugh. That self-belief, rooted in his ability to articulate frustration and absurdity, was his key tool.
And the Footlights environment brought him into contact with the men who would shape the next two decades of British comedy. Tim Brooke Taylor, Bill Oddie,
and his future primary writing partner, Graham Chapman.
Their 1963 Footlights review, A Clump of Plinths, became a sensation.
A huge sensation. It was quickly renamed Cambridge Circus, and it achieved a level of success that was just unheard of for a university production. It toured the West End, went all the way to New Zealand.
And eventually landed them on Broadway, which led to appearances on The Ed Sullivan Show in October 1964. The whole structure of British comedy was shifting dramatically, and Cleese was right at the vanguard.
And it was during his time performing Cambridge Circus in America, while he was appearing in the musical Half a Sixpence, that he met American actress Connie Booth.
Connie Booth is perhaps the most underrated creative partner of his entire career.
I'd agree with that. They married in 1968, and the details of their Unitarian ceremony in Manhattan perfectly illustrate Cleese's secular rigor. They actively tried to excise all theistic language from the ceremony.
And they almost succeeded. They fell short by only a single mention of the word God, which just speaks to his intense intellectual skepticism, even when he's dealing with deeply personal emotional events.
Upon returning to Britain, Cleese fully immersed himself in the BBC production machine. He's writing for various radio shows like The Dick Emery Show and joins the cast of, I'm sorry, I'll read that again.
It's worth noting here, he was sometimes credited as John Otto Cleese, maybe preferring to sideline his slightly stuffy middle name, Marwood.
Perhaps. But the true collaboration melting pot, the moment that really made Monty Python inevitable, was David Frost's The Frost Report, starting in 1965.
That writing staff was. It was just unprecedented. You had Cleese, Eric Idle, Terry Jones, and Michael Palin.
Alongside established greats like Marty Feldman, Barry Cryer, and the iconic duo, the Ronnie Beast Barker and Corbett, It was essentially the entire future of British sketch comedy, all clustered in one room.
It's unbelievable. And it was on the Frost Report that Cleese achieved his performing breakthrough with the classic Class sketch, screened in 1966. This wasn't just funny, it was a deeply structural piece of social analysis.
It really is. It's mandatory viewing for understanding British sociology. The genius of it lay in the physical and linguistic juxtaposition.
Right. So you have Cleese, the tallest of the three, playing the upper-class patrician, speaking in that clipped, confident accent of inherited wealth.
Then Ronnie Barker, middle class and middle height, speaks with a more anxious, careful tone.
Mm.
And Ronnie Corbett, the shortest, embodies the working class, with a thick accent and a deep sense of resentment.
Cleese delivers that defining line. I look down on him, Barker, because he's a middle-class oik. And Bark replies, I look up to him, Cleese, because he's upper-class, but I look down on him, Corbett, because he's lower-class.
And Corbett finishes with, I know my place. Precisely. The British Film Institute noted that this sketch, with its minimal script, was perfect because it physically and linguistically twinned height with social position. It made the entire rigid class structure instantly legible and hilariously absurd.
And this became Cleese's performance blueprint, didn't it? Exploit his stature, use clip, precise language, and then completely undermine the inherent superiority of that position.
Exactly. After the Frost Report, Cleese teamed up with Chapman, Brooke Taylor, and Feldman to write, at last, the 1948 show.
Which is significant because it's where they developed the Four Yorkshiremen sketch, a sketch that would become a Python staple, really showcasing that early collaboration.
But the pressure was mounting. Cleese grew profoundly frustrated with the writing dynamic with Chapman, largely because of Chapman's struggles with alcoholism. Cleese felt he was carrying an undue portion of the workload.
And this desire for efficiency and a better partnership, it directly caused the next great merger in British comedy.
It did. He invited Michael Palin, a writer he respected from the Frost Report for his reliability and creativity, to join him and Chapman.
And Palin, in turn, brought along the rest of his team from their show Do Not Adjust Your Set. So that's Terry Gilliam, the animator.
Terry Jones and Eric Idle. This wasn't some premeditated supergroup. It was an act of triage by Cleese to find a functional writing environment, and it resulted in the formation of the core of Monty Python.
So Monty Python's Flying Circus, it ran for four groundbreaking series between 1969 and 1974. But what's crucial for our deep dive here is that Cleese, the meticulous, quality-conscious writer, famously quit after the third series.
Yes, and he cited two major issues for that. Graham Chapman's continued issues with alcohol, and what he perceived as a declining quality in the writing output from the group as a whole.
That decision just highlights his absolute devotion to maintaining high standards, even at the cost of abandoning global fame.
Within Python, Cleese carved out two very distinct character archetypes, and both are rooted in his early rebellion against authority.
The first, which really capitalizes on his height and his education, is the sophisticate or the authority figure.
This is the role where he excels at bureaucratic absurdity. He plays the announcers, TV hosts, military figures, government officials. He uses his imposing stature, he's 6'5", and his precise diction to convey instant, unquestionable authority.
Only to have that authority reveal itself as utterly, ridiculously useless, or just plain mad.
The definitive example is the Ministry of Silly Walks. Cleese, wearing the suit of a high-level civil servant, exploits his long, crane-like legs to perform this grotesquely elaborate, entirely impractical walk just across the stage.
It's a perfect visual satire.
It is. The deadpan performance, the sheer, unblinking seriousness with which he performs this pointless labor, is what skewers the self-importance and inherent inefficiency of Whitehall bureaucracy. He doesn't need to say the system is wasteful. He shows the wastefulness in every absurd leg-flinging step. It's physical comedy rooted in intellectual critique.
And then there's his second great archetype, which is almost the opposite, the loony.
This is where the suppressed rage of the authority figure just breaks down into sheer, unadulterated madness. We see this in Mr. Preah, the Norwegian blue parrot owner.
Who delivers that increasingly specific and aggressive monologue of complaint.
Right. Or the proprietor of the cheese shop, whose calm, patronizing answers mask the ultimate ridiculous failure of his shop to stock a single item of cheese.
And whether he was playing the loony or the sophisticate, he was also the man in the dinner suit, known for that formal deadpan announcement.
And now for something completely different.
Which became the title of their first film, emphasizing the break from convention. Now, understanding the writing pairs within Python is essential. The Cleese-Chapman partnership, though personally challenging, produced Python's darkest, angriest, and most structurally unique material.
Absolutely. Cleese admitted Chapman was his greatest sounding board. The dynamic was often Cleese doing the structural, laborious work, setting the scene, writing the dialogue of frustration, until Chapman would arrive with a single, sudden, surreal suggestion that elevated the sketch from merely funny to iconic.
The dead parrot sketch is the textbook example of this creative synthesis.
It is. Cleese originally conceived it as a straightforward satire on poor customer service, involving maybe a faulty toaster or a broken car. He'd even used that premise in the pre-Python special, How to Irritate People.
But then Chapman, out of the blue, suggested changing the faulty item to a dead parrot.
And not just any parrot, but a Norwegian blue. This tiny detail transformed the sketch. It ceased being a relatable consumer complaint and became a descent into shared aggressive absurdity. The focus shifted from the failure of the product to the magnificent escalating rage of the customer, Mr. Praline. Cleese provides the rhetorical precision. Chapman provides the surreal element that makes it unforgettable.
Now, let's contrast that with the Cleese-Palin dynamic, which Cleese often cited as his favorite collaboration, mainly due to Palin's reliability.
Their sketches were based on a perfect theatrical opposition. They worked with contrast in two dimensions, physical size and temperament.
So you have Cleese's towering figure and his crazed aggression.
Think of the argument clinic bureaucrat whose whole job is just to argue.
Perfectly bounced off the shorter Palin's shuffling inoffensiveness. Palin was often the victim, quietly enduring Cleese's explosion, which often stemmed from these trivial bureaucratic frustrations.
And that seething, suppressed rage is Cleese's signature emotional contribution to Python. It's what differentiated his sketches from, say, Idle's more linguistic, wordplay-focused material. The rage was always palpable, just barely contained by the constraints of the suit or the office.
And that rage later refined itself into the most perfectly crafted character of post-Python British comedy. But before we get there, we should note that sometimes the dynamic flipped.
It did, as in the Fish License sketch, where Palin plays the stone-faced, immovably frustrating bureaucrat, while Cleese is the confused, increasingly desperate applicant. It's a brilliant reversal that still uses the same comedic architecture of frustrating officialdom.
Despite his temporary walkout from the TV show after the third series, Cleese remained integral to the big screen life of Python. He returned for all three main films, Monty Python and the Holy Grail in 75, Life of Brian in 79.
And The Meaning of Life in 1983. And his film roles are arguably even more quoted than his TV sketches, partly because they leverage his physical comedy to such high effect.
The Black Knight in Holy Grail.
Ooh, the Black Knight. Who sustains increasingly horrifying physical damage while maintaining his clipped absolute confidence. It's a brilliant, absurd fusion of physical pain and this unwavering, idiotic English stoicism.
And then, the intellectual genius of his role in Life of Brian, when he attacks Roman rule by asking the group, "What have the Romans ever done for us?"
And he's immediately met with a string of undeniable benefits. Roads, sanitation, wine, public order.
It's perfect satire. It uses the logic of political argument, starting with a sweeping, biased premise, and immediately undercuts it with empirical, undeniable facts. It was ranked the 7th funniest line in film in a 2002 poll, which just shows how his blend of high intellect and theatrical delivery resonated globally.
His commitment continued well beyond the films, too. He participated in various live performances, notably Monty Python Live at the Hollywood Bowl in 82 and the final reunion, Monty Python Live, mostly, in 2014. It really showcased the enduring bond even after Chapman's death.
That bond was never more evident or more darkly humorous than the eulogy Cleese gave at Graham Chapman's memorial service in 1989.
Cleese's use of black humor there was deliberate and powerful.
He delivered the infamous line, "Good riddance to him, the freeloading bastard. I hope he fries." It was shocking, but perfectly fitting for their relationship and the whole tone of Python.
And Cleese himself explicitly stated that he traced his fondness for black humor to his mother, who lived to be 101. He saw this eulogy, along with the dead parrot sketch and the Kipper and the Corpse episode of Fawlty Towers, as necessary, cathartic uses of dark comedy to cope with the absurdity of life and death.
Okay, before we get to Fawlty Towers, we have to contextualize his brief period in academia and governance. From 1970 to 1973, he served as rector of the University of St. Andrews.
Right, a position that's historically been seen as mostly ceremonial.
But Cleese treated it seriously. He actively modernized the post, changing the assessor deputy role from an often ignored traditional figure into a position for an elected student,
which gave the students direct representation and influence on the university court. It's yet another example of Cleese, the anti-authoritarian, using an establishment position to dismantle entrenched arbitrary systems.
The true cultural explosion, however, was Basil Fawlty. Fawlty Towers. It only ran for two short series, 1975 and 1979, totaling just 12 episodes.
Just 12. And yet the show is consistently ranked as the greatest British sitcom of all time.
And the short run is the secret to its genius, isn't it?
Absolutely. Cleese and Connie Booth insisted on that limit to avoid compromising quality, unlike American sitcoms that are designed for endless renewal. The intensity, the pacing, the structural perfection of those 12 episodes are a direct result of that self-imposed constraint.
And the inspiration for this masterpiece came directly from a real person, Donald Sinclair. The Python team encountered him in 1970 while staying at the Glen Eagles Hotel in Torquay.
And Cleese later famously described him as the most wonderfully rude man I have ever met.
The anecdotes that fueled Basil are just terrifyingly specific.
Oh, they are. Sinclair allegedly found Eric Idle's briefcase suspicious and threw it out of the hotel in case it contained a bomb. He complained bitterly about Terry Gilliam's American table manners, suggesting they were vulgar.
And the bus timetable.
The bus timetable. In one astonishing incident, he threw a bus timetable at a guest who dared to ask when the next bus was due.
You can see the birth of Basil in those details, that high-stress, arbitrary, petty cruelty directed at guests. Basil is Sinclair filtered through Cleese's comedic lens of suppressed rage.
And the physical comedy of Basil, the tiptoeing, the manic flailing, the way his body language constantly betrays his anxiety, that's Cleese channeling his personal neuroses into a creative pressure cooker.
What makes the show even more remarkable is the writing partnership. The second series was written and aired after Cleese and Connie Booth had divorced in 1978.
Which is incredible. They were able to successfully revive their creative collaboration despite the personal separation, demonstrating a level of professional dedication and commitment to the material that is almost unprecedented.
The accolades just underscore this achievement. Cleese won the 1980 BAFTA for Best Entertainment Performance. The show topped the BFI's 100 Greatest British Television Programs in 2000.
And Basil Fawlty was ranked second only to Homer Simpson in a 2001 poll of the 100 Greatest TV Characters. That confirms his global cultural impact.
And if we look at the specific lines that resonate, it's always the moment the pressure overcomes him. Basil's desperate whispered, "Don't mention the war" comment in the Germans episode.
It was ranked the second funniest line in television in 2002. It perfectly captures his frantic attempts to maintain a veneer of British politeness while his suppressed aggression threatens to erupt into total chaos.
So as Fawlty Towers was cementing his legacy, Cleese made a very interesting pivot by co-founding Video Arts. This wasn't a standard show business venture.
No, this was yet another fusion of his dual interests, comedy and instruction. Video Arts produced highly entertaining training films like Meetings, Bloody Meetings. Cleese recognized that traditional corporate training was often dull and ineffective. So by using high-quality comedy and performance, often starring himself as the exasperated narrator or manager, he made complex business processes, like chairing a meeting, palatable and memorable.
This business venture demonstrates his practical, intellectual side, the desire to apply principles of structure and clarity, which he honed in comedy writing, to the corporate world.
The 1980s saw him diversify his film roles. We see him in Terry Gilliam's Time Bandits in 81 as a very proper British Robin Hood.
Then he took that surprisingly dramatic role as the silver-haired sheriff in the Western Silverado in 85, showing he could dial back the overt comedy.
But his next major comedic role solidified his post-Fawlty archetype, the punctuality-obsessed headmaster in the successful British comedy Clockwise from 1986.
And Clockwise won him the Peter Sellers Award for Comedy. The character's rigid adherence to timing and schedule, which unravels spectacularly throughout the film.
It's just Basil Fawlty's psychological rigidity applied to the school system. It demonstrates how Cleese could mine that specific neurotic vein for enduringly successful comedy.
And this is where he truly conquered Hollywood, but on his own terms. In 1988, Cleese wrote and starred in A Fish Called Wanda,
playing the stifled, respectable barrister Archie Leach, a deliberate homage to Cary Grant's birth name.
Wanda was a phenomenal global success, both critically and commercially. It was in the top 10 highest-grossing films of the year in the U.S.
And Cleese earned an Academy Award nomination for Best Original Screenplay and won the BAFTA for Best Actor. The film is a masterclass in contrasting British repression Archie Leach with American volatility and immorality.
The core of the comedy lies in Archie Leach's emotional breakdown. Cleese, the actor who perfected suppressed rage, finally gets to unleash it in this series of magnificent, humiliating tantrums.
Including stripping naked in front of his neighbor and eating fish while crying. It's the ultimate payoff for years of playing characters who are just about to burst.
It's also important to remember the quasi-sequel, Fierce Creatures, from 1997, which tried to reunite the cast.
And Cleese was later completely frank about it, stating that making the follow-up was a mistake. A rare public regret he ranked alongside his ill-fated third marriage, a highly entertaining, self-deprecating admission about the difficulty of recapturing creative magic.
Following Wanda, Cleese transitioned into being this high-profile, reliable British character actor for major franchises. He was introduced in the James Bond series as R, Q's assistant, in The World Is Not Enough.
And was then promoted to the full quartermaster, or Q, role in Die Another Day in 2002. He brought a touch of dry, bureaucratic exasperation to the role, a perfect continuation of his career trajectory. He even reprised the role in the video game Everything or Nothing.
And for a generation that grew up in the early 2000s, he is indelibly linked to the role of nearly headless Nick in the first two Harry Potter films.
And he voiced King Harold in the last three Shrek films. We should also revisit the film Rat Race from 2001, where he starred as Donald P. Sinclair.
An eccentric hotel owner who sets the entire chaotic plot in motion. An explicit, self-aware reference to the real-life Donald Sinclair who inspired Basil Fawlty.
Exactly. It showcases Cleese's acknowledgement of his own comedic DNA and his willingness to recycle and comment upon his greatest creation.
His ability to pivot between highbrow satire, academic pursuits, and mainstream Hollywood roles is truly unparalleled. And he also earned significant critical praise for his television guest roles.
Right. He won a primetime Emmy for Cheers in 87 and got nominations for Third Rock from the Sun and Will and Grace.
It's so easy to focus on the comedy of aggression and cynicism in Cleese's work that his humanitarian record often gets overlooked.
It does. And he was the primary driving force behind the Secret Policeman's Ball benefit shows, starting in 1976. This is an absolutely essential part of his legacy.
These shows raise significant funds and awareness for Amnesty International.
Martin Lewis, a co-founder, detailed how the project started with Cleese handing over a check signed J. Cleese and then promising to round up a few friends, who were, of course, the Pythons and a host of other A-list comedians.
The impact was monumental. It provided a blueprint for celebrity activism. Musicians like Bob Geldof and Sting have publicly attributed their own major benefit organizing efforts, including Live Aid, directly to the inspiration provided by Cleese and the Python Group.
And this creates that fundamental, crucial paradox we've been touching on. The man whose creative output perfected the art of suppressed, small-minded rage
was simultaneously dedicated to fighting large-scale, actual human rights abuses perpetrated by genuine oppressive authority.
His commitment to dismantling bad systems was professional, philosophical, and personal.
And his engagement with the academic world extends far beyond his brief rector role. He served as provost's visiting professor at Cornell University.
After being the prestigious Andrew D. White Professor at Large from 1999 to 2006.
And that professorship is designed to bring prominent international thinkers to Cornell to foster interdisciplinary conversation.
And Cleese used this platform not just to talk about comedy, but about creativity, psychology, and organizational behavior. It's evidence of his profound intellectual curiosity and his desire to engage with serious thought outside the comedy industry.
This interest led directly to a very unique collaboration, co-writing two dialogue books with English psychiatrist Robin Skiner on relationships.
Families and How to Survive Them, and Life and How to Survive It. This partnership is fascinating. Skiner provided the psychological framework, and Cleese brought his clarity, his ability to structure complex information, and his dry wit to make the dense material accessible.
So these books directly address the roots of the neurosis and repressed communication that fuel his best comedy.
They do. They provide a deep dive into the psychological background of characters like Basil Fawlty and Archie Leach. Cleese was attempting to analyze and perhaps exercise his own demons through collaborative nonfiction.
And just to prove he hadn't lost his touch for absurdity, he also co-wrote the DC Comics graphic novel Superman, True Brit, in 2004, an Elseworlds story imagining the ultimate American hero landing in Britain instead.
And navigating the inherent awkwardness of British culture. It's a perfect side project for him.
Now, Cleese has always been upfront about the source of his dark black humor. He points to his mother and his own deep-seated frustration.
And he cites the dead parrot, the Fawlty Towers funeral episode, and Chapman's eulogy as examples where humor acts as a necessary defense mechanism against the bleakness of reality. His famous claim, "I can take almost nothing seriously."
And that specific worldview is now the engine of his current and most controversial public stance, his passionate critique of what he calls wokeism and political correctness.
Cleese argues that political correctness acts as a severe, damaging constraint on creativity and freedom of expression. He contends that PC has become an indulgence of the most oversensitive people and fundamentally misunderstands how humor operates.
His core argument is that PC people simply don't understand this business about context.
Right. If you have to constantly check your language for offense, he argues, you operate out of fear, and fear stifles the necessary spontaneity required for creative risk-taking.
This came to a head in 2020, following the temporary removal of the Fawlty Towers episode, The Germans, from the UK TV service.
And Cleese responded with explosive criticism, calling the BBC bureaucracy cowardly and gutless. His argument was clear. The episode was not endorsing prejudice. It was ridiculing it by placing the prejudiced behavior in the hands of the show's central buffoon, Basil.
He used the comparison of the satirical function of Alf Garnett's reactionary views in Till Death Us. Do part viewers laughed at Garnett to discredit his views, not with him.
And Cleese felt that the bureaucracy was too cowardly to trust the audience's intelligence in discerning satire.
The controversy escalated further in 2021 when he preemptively blacklisted himself from an appearance at the Cambridge Union Society.
This was a deliberate act of performance art as protest. After learning that an art historian had been blacklisted by the union for performing an impression of Adolf Hitler, part of a lecture demonstrating satire's uses, Cleese cancels his own planned appearance.
Stating he was blacklisting myself before someone else does.
It was a classic Cleese move, using absurdity to satirize a bureaucratic or cultural overreach he found deeply objectionable.
Cleese's political journey has been complex, its move from the center-left to the Euroskeptic right, always driven by a distrust of entrenched systems.
He was an early and staunch supporter of the Liberal Democrats and the original SDP, the Social Democratic Party, after its formation in 1981.
His support for the SDP Liberal Alliance in the late 80s was primarily rooted in his strong belief in proportional representation.
Yes, he recorded a party political broadcast advocating for it in 1987. This shows consistency. He wanted the voting system itself to be more inherently fair and less arbitrary, which aligns perfectly with his lifelong philosophical opposition to unearned power.
Despite this sustained political engagement, he's famously uninterested in the establishment honors that often accompany success. In 1996, he declined a CBE title.
Commander of the Most Excellent Order of the British Empire. He just thought such honors were silly and unnecessary. This lack of interest in official validation is a recurring theme.
He also declined an offer for a life peerage from the Liberal Democrats in 1999, which would have made him a member of the House of Lords.
And his reasoning was classic Cleese humor, prioritizing his own comfort. He joked that he realized this involved being in England in the winter, and I thought that was too much of a price to pay.
It's an easy joke, but it speaks volumes about his detachment from the institutional vanity that often defines UK politics.
And Cleese has never shied away from global political commentary. In 2008, he supported Barack Obama's presidential candidacy, even offering his services as a speechwriter.
He also took that gentle, Python-esque swipe at Sarah Palin, quipping that Michael Palin was no longer the funniest Palin.
And in 2016, his assessment of Donald Trump was just scathing. He characterized him as a narcissist with no attention span.
This criticism aligns with his contempt for unprincipled or unserious authority figures.
Closer to home, he praised the UK coalition government in 2011 for what he perceived as a more courteous tone in politics, while criticizing the previous Labour government, particularly Gordon Brown, who he claimed lacked emotional intelligence. A critique drawn directly from his work with Skinner.
The biggest public shift, however, came with his views on Europe. In 2014, he expressed interest in the UK Independence Party, UKIP.
He was attracted to UKIP primarily because of their challenge to the established political order and the radical nature of their EU policies. Cleese framed his interest around the desire for systemic change and the removal of bureaucracy.
He supported immigration in principle, but raised concerns about cultural integration.
This crystallized into his public support for Brexit in 2016. He tweeted that he would vote to leave because he felt that EU bureaucrats had taken away any trace of democratic accountability.
And this stance, whether you agree with it or not, is entirely consistent with the 17-year-old who lost respect for authority at Clifton College. His view of the EU was that it was a colossal, undemocratic bureaucracy, and he wanted out.
His frustration with the political debate itself, which he called full of dreadful lies, ultimately led to his physical departure from the country. In 2018, he relocated to the Caribbean island of Nevis.
Citing frustration over the standards of the Brexit debate and issues with the press and the voting system, he literally left the bureaucracy behind.
And in 2019, he ignited a significant public firestorm when he stated that London was no longer an English city, suggesting the character of the city had changed too dramatically.
London Mayor Sadiq Khan famously responded by suggesting Cleese's comments made him sound like he was in character as Basil Fawlty.
And Cleese responded by doubling down, arguing he was nostalgic for the England of his youth, which he described as calmer, more polite, more humorous, less tabloid, and less money-oriented. This entire clash is the ultimate modern paradox of Cleese, the progressive activist who resists the modern reality of multiculturalism.
In recent years, Cleese has maintained his role as a political provocateur. In 2022, he spoke at the conference of the Revival Social Democratic Party,
demonstrating that his interest in center ground, systemic reform, remains strong, even if the parties themselves have fractured.
And we saw a highly controversial event in 2025 with the cancellation of his planned performances in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv.
He canceled the shows due to threats from the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions, or BDS organization, citing safety concerns.
What makes this particularly complex is that, according to our sources, at the same time he was canceling the shows, he was reposting anti-Israel content on his X account.
It illustrates the tightrope he walks, protecting his professional interests from political threat while simultaneously maintaining a highly critical and provocative stance on a sensitive international issue. His public life is just defined by this persistent, sometimes contradictory, critical engagement.
Cleese's on-screen characters often deal with marital frustration, and his personal life certainly reflects this neurosis. He's been married 4 times.
Connie Booth from 1968 to 78, Barbara Trentham from 81 to 90, Alice Eichelberger from 92 to 2008, and Jennifer Wade since 2012.
He has 2 daughters, Cynthia with Booth and Camilla with Trentham. But the divorce that generated the most media detention and perhaps the most Basil-like bitterness was the end of his marriage to Alice Eichelberger in 2008.
The financial cost was astronomical. The settlement resulted in £12 million in finance and assets, including £600,000 a year for 7 years.
His quote about the settlement perfectly captures the black humor that defines his personal pain.
It does. He famously quipped that he got off lightly, considering what he would have had to pay if she had contributed, such as children or a conversation. That level of aggressive, passive-aggressive sarcasm directed at his own life choices is where the professional and personal lines absolutely blur.
That sustained conflict led him to introspect deeply on the origins of his relationship problems, and he consistently blamed his mother, Muriel, who lived to 101, for instilling the emotional habits that doomed his marriages.
He stated that his ingrained habit of walking on eggshells when dealing with my mother dominated my romantic liaisons. This is key context for understanding the internal tension of his characters. He's noted he's received treatment for depression and spent a large part of my life in some form of therapy.
So the comedy of neurosis is not an act.
No, it's the public manifestation of a lifelong struggle with suppressed anxiety and communication failure. Exactly the themes he explored with Robin Skiner.
Okay, shifting gears to one of the most delightful and surprising facts about him. Cleese has an intense, profound passion for lemurs.
He really does. He once stated, "I adore lemurs. They're extremely gentle, well-mannered, pretty, and yet great fun. I should have married one."
And this is more than a quirky hobby. It's a commitment. In 1998, he hosted the BBC documentary In the Wild, Operation Lemur, with John Cleese,
which tracked the reintroduction of black and white rough lemurs in Madagascar. And he backed that commitment financially, personally funding part of the project by donating the proceeds from the London premiere of Fierce Creatures.
This dedication resulted in the ultimate unique honor.
In 2005, the Bemaraha Woolly Lemur of Ahi Cleesi was named in his honor by the scientists who discovered it, specifically recognizing his fondness and conservation efforts. From a family named Cheese to having a rare Madagascan species named Cleesi, it's a truly bizarre yet fitting trajectory.
When analyzing his impact, we have to look at the unique spectrum of tributes he has received, spanning the celestial and the terrestrial. He has an asteroid named after him, 9618 John Cleese,
placing him among the stars. But reflecting his talent for generating frustration and resentment, he also has a 45-meter municipal rubbish heap outside Palmerston North, New Zealand, named Mint Cleese.
This followed a stay in 2005 where, after expressing displeasure with the city, he dubbed it the suicide capital of New Zealand.
He is one of the few people who can insult a nation and receive a landmark named after him in return.
In terms of recent career moves, he began presenting a new show on GB News in October 2023 called The Dinosaur Hour, a title that perhaps hints at his perspective on his own place in the modern cultural landscape.
Finally, we have to ask the question of what might have been. Cleese revealed a striking list of iconic roles he turned down.
The role played by Robin Williams in The Birdcage.
Anthony Hopkins' dramatic role in The Remains of the Day.
And Peter Cook's role in The Princess Bride.
Considering the massive, enduring success of those films, one an Oscar winner, one a cultural staple, was this tendency to say no evidence of creative genius maintaining high standards? Or was it the professional manifestation of the neurosis and overanalysis that cost him some of the most iconic roles of the last few decades?
It's likely both. It's that constant tension between the fastidious planner and the spontaneous creative, between the man who demanded perfection and the man whose own life was defined by chaos.
Mm.
So to synthesize Cleese's mastery, we have to recognize him as a towering, brilliant performer whose true genius lies in his meticulousness as a writer. The 12-episode limit for Fawlty Towers, the structural perfection of the Dead Parrot sketch, the books on psychology.
All of it is evidence of an intense commitment to quality control and efficiency in service of profound insight.
His legacy is defined by the core paradox we've explored. He created the aggressive, rage-filled authority figure characters like Basil Fawlty.
Yet he was simultaneously a dedicated humanitarian who founded the Secret Policeman's Ball and engaged seriously with academia at Cornell. The anger was the tool of his comedy, and the activism was the commitment to the principles he fought for.
The thread that binds his entire career is his lifelong battle against arbitrary authority, whether that system is the British class structure, a hapless hotel, EU bureaucracy, or most recently, cultural standards he perceives as stifling creativity.
So what does this all mean for you, the well-informed listener? John Cleese, a man who built his fame on the premise that he could take almost nothing seriously, now believes that political correctness and wokeism pose the most serious threat to the free expression and creative risk-taking that gave birth to his own unique neurotic genius.
Is his alarm justified, or is he simply playing the latest iteration of Basil Fawlty, yelling at the modern world from his Caribbean retreat? That is a profound question worth exploring as you witness the ongoing clash between satire and sensitivity in modern culture.